You weren't. We weren't.
We will call the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement to order. Good morning to everyone. We do have a quorum, but we are a couple of members have had to step out for a little bit, and but we're going to go ahead and get started with our work for today. For those of you who were not able to be with us yesterday, let me just give you a brief recap on what this is all about. The this commission had a late start this spring in getting organized and started. We actually really didn't begin as a commission until around the 1st of May. And so we were only able to do a limited bill last session. But we did have some very significant things included in that bill, including allowing the consolidation of the Minneapolis Police and Fire into the state fund, and also providing some support for St. Paul teachers and what they were able to do and recommending. Plus, a number of individual legislators had provisions that we were able to incorporate. So even though we had a short time, we had, I think, a number of significant accomplishments during that period of time. But several of us on the commission are new to the commission, and we felt it was very important for bringing everybody sort of up to speed on the issues that this commission will need to address. And so we determined last spring that we needed to have a series of meetings this fall to bring everybody up to speed and to also give the commission an opportunity to study key issues, major issues with regard to pension in the state of Minnesota. We all feel that the reforms that were enacted in 2010 were a very positive thing. Yesterday we had reconfirmed that those actions actually saved about almost $6 billion in costs to the state of Minnesota for our pensions. And what we are looking to do now is to see what other kinds of things we might be able to do to protect the long-term viability of our pension funds so that the state of Minnesota can keep its promises to the people who have worked for us over the years. Yesterday we heard about the retirement plans design study that took a look at the issue of defined benefit versus defined contribution and the possibility of hybrids. We spent a considerable amount of time doing that. We took some testimony with regard to that set of issues, and some of that carries over to this morning, and I'll be calling on someone to follow up on that issue. We also talked about the issue of the interest rate assumptions, the earnings assumptions on the investments that we have, and had some good discussion and presentation on that. Our plan today is to pick up on anything that didn't get the chance to be discussed or questions asked on yesterday. We have to look at our commission budget for the years ahead, and we have to look at a revised actuarial services contract. And then we're going to spend a significant amount of time towards the end of our session this morning talking about the agenda for our next series of meetings. We will meet again as a commission on October 19th and 20th. That's a Wednesday, Thursday, basically on the same schedule we're following this time. And then again on November 9th and 10th. And our hope is that we will be able to frame some of the elements of things that we would like to see in a bill to present to the legislature next session. We are not going to be hearing individual bills during this fall's session. We'll do that starting in January. But instead, we'll see this fall what kinds of issues that the commission would like to see addressed in a legislation next session. So with that recap, for those of you who weren't able to be here, we're going to pick up where we left off yesterday on Mr. Elliott's side from AFSCME. Wasn't able to be with us yesterday, and he would like to particularly comment about the design study and the issue of defined benefit versus defined contribution, and anything else he would like to share with the commission. So, Mr. Side, welcome.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the opportunity to be with you today, and thank you for your patience with my schedule yesterday. It's very kind of you and the commission. I appreciate that. I also wanted to just comment that I truly appreciate your comments this morning in terms of the protecting the funds and a promise to workers. That's appreciated by the members that I represent. And it's been that kind of prudent approach over the years of shared responsibility, a labor management approach between the employers and the employees, and also between a bipartisan approach that's allowed us to create one of the more stable pension funds in the United States. And so I appreciate your comments this morning, sir, related to what the commission's doing and what it's going to be looking at. Let me just start out by saying that we believe that, first of all, my name's Elliott Side, and I'm the director of AFSCME Council 5. We represent 43,000 public and nonprofit workers throughout the state of Minnesota. We represent nearly 18,000 of Minnesota's state employees. We represent about 15,000 to 16,000 county employees. We represent city employees in major cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and suburban cities in the metro and suburban cities in the Duluth Arrowhead area. We also represent school boards, Minneapolis, Duluth, St. Paul, and other school boards in the suburban areas of the Twin Cities and Duluth. We have a lot of members whose pension is at stake. And pension and health care, I would say, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission, are the most important issues to our members in terms of their security, their future security, their present security. Those are the issues that matter most to them. Just on a personal basis, since I don't know everyone on the commission, they don't know me, I'm in on October 22nd, I'll have completed 33 years of advocating for public workers. Most of that in Minnesota, but in other states as well. And I am not a lawyer, and I am not an actuary, but I am an advocate for public service workers, and one unabashedly and unapologetically. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Minnesota's pension funds, Mr. Chairman and members, we believe are stable, are prudently managed, and are recovering quite well from the largest stock market drop in our lifetime. And I know yesterday you saw the numbers that were given out by the various funds, but just to repeat, we are now gone to an actuarial value in the PRA plan of 74.8%, in the MSRS plan of 85.6%. And those are the plans where we represent folks. PRA has also improved its status over that time. Unlike states like New Jersey, Illinois, and some of the other states where I know one of the testifiers said there was crisis in pension throughout the country, Minnesota's never been like that. Every year, and I've been working in the state since 1980, every year that, except for 1982, where there was a little dispute about 2%, I'm sure everyone's heard about that at one time or another. But outside of that, every year employers have religiously made their contributions, employees have made their contributions. This has been a very stable environment. And every time we've encountered problems, we've dealt with them together, Democrats and Republicans, employers and employees, labor and management. And I think that's one of the reasons we have one of the more stable funds around. But this bipartisan labor management prudent approach was demonstrated, Mr. Chairman and members, in 2006, 2008, and 2010, when our union, AFSCME Council 5, and other public sector unions across the state supported the post-fund reforms, supported and eliminated the large increases and spikes we had, Mr. Chairman, so we could flatten that, the returns, to make that more predictable and not create winners and losers, and also be able to plan better. We already have supported, our members have voted on over and over again to make sure that these funds would be available in the future, and they've voted to support increases in employee contributions in 2008. And again, in 2010, we also supported and were a big part of the 2010 package and supported it very, you know, even though it was a package that cut the COLAs on our folks, we supported that package in order to create the stability that the fund needed so that we could recover from the stock market crash that's had so not only devastated, you know, this state and this pension fund, but the entire nation and indeed the world economy. So we've taken a number of prudent efforts over the years. The employees of the state and of the counties, as well as our union, to make sure that we have disciplined funding, we have modest benefits. We have a fund where, unlike many funds across the country, employees here have always contributed to the funds. In the MSRS fund, we are split it 5%, 5%. In the PRA fund, the employer pays slightly more, but employees are paying 6.125%, I believe, is the number, on out of their pockets for their pensions. So employees have a skin in the game, as they say, and care about the future of this. This is deferred income. And, again, I can't say enough how much I appreciate your comments, Mr. Chairman, about making sure the funds are available and secure for the future and that this is a promise to Minnesota's employees. That's indeed how we see it. And we took a look at, and I just last night and this morning, you know, read the scintillating study again on that was done. It was a very good study, a very in-depth study, but very scintillating reading last night, again this morning, on the of the defined contribution, defined benefit study that was done by the fund directors. And as I know, the commission already knows, Mr. Chairman, it would not be prudent, given our budget and economic situation, to switch to a defined contribution fund where the cost to do that would be approximately $2.76 billion in the coming years. That wouldn't be good for the state's fiscal situation. And I would suggest, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, not good for the state's economy. One of the problems that we have in this country, and one of the problems that Social Security was created for, and defined benefit pensions were, was to deal with poverty in people who are retired. And I think it's an important part of this discussion to remember that. Defined benefit pensions, when you take a defined benefit pension and you take Social Security and you put that together along with whatever private savings an individual is able to put together, that's the difference between poverty, a retirement of poverty, and a retirement of dignity. And certainly after people worked a whole lifetime, they're entitled to a retirement with dignity. I just wanted to share with you a couple of numbers according to 2006 data that defined benefit plans saved the federal government $7.3 billion in public assistance. Defined benefit plans have kept 1.72 million households nationally out of poverty and 2.97 million out of near poverty. And it has reduced the number of households on income-based public assistance by 1.35 million folks. That's a major saving. So there's a cost and there's a savings. It allowed those folks who did have that defined benefit plan to retire with dignity. I want to let you know that in AFSCME bargaining units in state service, we make on average $38,000 a year. That's our income. And in fact, as much to our chagrin, the good side of having flat incomes and four zeros in the last 8 years has been that it's kept the payout on the benefits a little bit lower. So at least there was some benefit to our members in terms of the deferred stability of the plan by those four zeros. In AFSCME, I know in the study it talks about the average state retiree pension is about $16,000 and change a year. In AFSCME, it's closer to $14,000 a year. A very modest pension indeed. The other thing I wanted to mention about that is the economic impact of our pensions around the state. Minnesota's pension systems pay out more than $2.5 billion. They add about $3.5 billion to the state's economy and create 22,500 jobs. And that this the very important point, the 90% of our retirees in Minnesota stay in the state. And I would add, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission, that then I don't have the empirical evidence, and I'm going to try to get it. Anecdotally, though, I can tell you, a lot of the retirees who retire here in the Twin Cities then move to greater Minnesota, and they spend those pension dollars in greater Minnesota. And eliminating that pension, I'm not suggesting, Mr. Chairman, you're talking about that, but if we were to do that, I know there are some advocates who want to go to defined contribution, eliminate the defined benefit, would have an even greater economic impact on the communities of greater Minnesota than the Twin Cities, because public employees and pensioners make up a bigger share of those local economies than they do in the Twin Cities. So I think the impact on Minnesota's economy is also very important. I also wanted to make sure that I highlight to the committee that state and local taxes collected on our pensions exceed the public employer pension contribution by $80 million a year. So, in fact, the taxes paid on those pensions, and we've been taxing pensions in Minnesota since the 80s. There was a debate about that, if I remember, when I had dark hair and hair to begin with, and a mustache back then. I think Mr. Martin may remember that. In fact, we tax Minnesota's pensions, and so we actually take in more in tax dollars than we pay out on that. So that's another important economic fact. Another equally important fact for taxpayers is there's been this notion or rhetoric, again, not from our chairman or not that I know of from members of this commission, but that somehow that this is a major burden on Minnesota taxpayers and that Minnesota taxpayers are paying the cost of public worker defined benefit pensions. And in fact, Minnesota taxpayers pay for only 18 cents of every public of every dollar in public pension benefits. Employees contribute 15 cents, the rest, the 67 cents, comes from investments. So, in fact, employee contributions, taxpayer contributions, and by the way, our members are paying twice, because I would remind the commission that our members are paying as employees and they're paying as taxpayers, because public workers are citizens. Members of our neighborhoods, our cousins, our friends, our sisters, our brothers, and they pay taxes in our community too. So 18 cents from taxpayers, 15 cents from employees, and 67 cents from interest. A defined benefit plan focuses on how much is paid to the retired worker. A defined contribution focuses on how much goes into the plan. And if we look at the recent stock market's fluctuations of volatility, it takes professional investment managers to work through that kind of environment. Purely anecdotally and personally, as the father of a 24-year-old and a 22-year-old who saved my whole life for their college education, in the recent stock market situation, and I hoped I did what I did prudently, but they've lost probably a year and a half of tuition in public institutions, one here at the University of Minnesota and the other at the State University of New York at Albany. Plus a year and a half of that they're now having to take loans out for do that, which, of course, will increase their burden as life begins. The stock market for individuals is a tricky play. When we have professional investment managers deal with this, like the State Investment Fund, who basically outperforms the benchmarks on a regular basis, that's the way to do the investment. When you switch it to individuals, you're looking at a much riskier situation for the individual, a much riskier situation for the future retirement, and a riskier situation in what is, I think we all agree, a fairly volatile stock market situation. Again, Mr. Chairman, you reported at the outset that that as a result of the combination of actions that we took, this legislature, at the time, Governor Plenty, the unions, the employees, the counties, the cities, as employers, we have closed the gap. We eliminated almost $6 billion in pension liability with the reforms that we did. And as a result, we've talked about the kind of funding levels that we currently have at present on our pension system. One of the other items I wanted to point out again is that even though we had some speakers yesterday, I've been told by Julie Blyle, our very capable legislative director, who came up here and talked about the national crisis in pensions and how much it's costing various states and counties. We do not have a crisis. And I would suggest, Mr. Chairman and members, that we don't try to create a solution looking for a problem. We have worked diligently to solve our problem, and I would just again point out that nationally, the median employee rates are equal or greater than the median nationally. So here in Minnesota, public employees are paying at the median or greater than the national median for employee contributions, and that the employers, because I know there's a great concern, and we share it, obviously, as active as representing thousands of active members in state and local government, but the employers are far lower than the median on the national average, or one point. And so I think that's a very important fact. We here in Minnesota pay 1.6% of total state and local spending is spent on our pension fund. So as a percentage of total state and local spending, we're talking 1.6%. Nationally, the average is 2.9%. Again, I think it's a result here in Minnesota of a bipartisan labor management, prudent cooperative approach, employees having significant skin in the game by making contributions, and a responsible attitude by employers, by employees, and by the legislature in trying to stave off some of the impacts that we've seen in places like New Jersey and Illinois. The study talks about, defined contribution plans. First of all, again, I want to indicate defined benefit plans allow our members and workers to plan for the future. It's also a way at a time when we've had flat wages. And let's face it, working in the public sector right now, you better have some extra skin, because public workers have been frankly, demonized, dehumanized, and treated in a way that I think has been very unfair to them nationally, and by some folks here in this state, Chairman very definitely excluded from that. But that's been going on. It's hard to get people to stay. In fact, not only did we have a loss of 1,590. Employees in the AFSCME bargaining units from in the 8 years of Governor Pawlenty, and that's according to the bonding documents of government, 1,590 folks lost, but 422 folks took the early retirement incentive, which was in our membership, which was the highest total of any group, a single group in the state, because people are demoralized in terms of the public sector, in terms of work, in terms of how they're being perceived, what they think their future is. Public defined benefit pensions are a way we can still attract the best and the brightest to Minnesota. It is shown in study after study that people take these jobs because of the defined benefit pension. And when we look at a hybrid situation like the state of Washington, where you have that sort of hybrid, when given the choice, employees, including young employees, pick defined benefit over defined contribution by huge numbers. And the reason is because they know what the future will bring. They know that in the future they will be able to calculate what their income is based on the formula for it that's laid out, depending on how many years they work. So I think that's another important point, retention and attraction of the best and the brightest. We're not paying higher wages anymore. We certainly aren't. We're in a situation, again, of an attack on the public sector. And in order to attract the kind of workers we would like to attract, in order to have the best and the brightest work in the public sector, defined benefit helps us do that. So we've talked about a couple of things. We've talked about the fact that that our plan, as compared to other plans around the country, is well-funded, has acted in a prudent and a cooperative way. We've talked about the economic impact of the plan on the state, and we've talked about the fact that defined benefit plans help keep people out of poverty, which also save public sector costs. If retirees are going on public assistance, then that raises taxpayer costs on paying for that public assistance. And it's better, and also better for the individual. It's more dignified to be able to support themselves and their families as they go into retirement. So we've pointed that out, too. And we've pointed out that the plan here in Minnesota, in terms of employer costs, is below the median nationally, and in terms of employee costs, is at or above the median nationally. So we made a lot of changes from 2006 to 2010, particularly in 2010 as a culmination of that 4 years. And as you pointed out, it's resulted in some fairly remarkable results, savings of nearly $6 billion. The actuarial values of the plans are rebounding very nicely and moving in the right direction. We think that the best thing at this point is to let these reforms that we've done over the last 4 years take their course, let them stabilize the fund. We don't have a crisis in Minnesota. Regardless, I heard about the Pew study yesterday. I'm familiar with that. We heard about New Jersey and Illinois. Heard about that. We are not New Jersey. We're not Illinois. We're Minnesota. We have a history of prudent management of our plan, and we are going in the right direction. We would suggest let's let those, you know, this is a long-term proposition. One of the benefits of defined benefit over defined contribution is that given the aggregation of investment income, you can spread risk over more people. It takes time, but the long run is the consideration here. But even in the short run, we've shown great progress. And we believe over not too a long period of time, with these ratios will improve even further. So with that, Mr. Chairman, again, I appreciate the opportunity to come before this commission. I hope some of the things I've said have some worth to members of the commission, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have of me or my union about our positions on these issues.
Well, thank you, Mr. Seid. Yesterday, we didn't have an opportunity to see if there were others who wished to speak to the study that Mr. Seid and others have responded to. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to come before the commission to express a view about that? Representative Murphy, did you have a...
Mr. Chair, not about that, but if Mr. Seid could address the 8.5 or the 8%.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Representative Murphy. My understanding is that when we looked at this, and you know, we've just started to look at it within the last week, that my understanding is, and I believe I'm correct about this, that over the last 20 years, and I know Mr. Bicker is here, over the last 20 years, I believe it is, in 20 to 25 years, we've met the actuarial rate of return. In the last decade, obviously with the early 2000s and then the huge drop in 2009, all seems like the same year to me after a while. We also saw a significant drop in the market, and there's some discussion now that we may need to change the actuarial assumption on the rate of return, possibly from 8.5 to 8.25 or perhaps lower. Our recommendation on that, and we're still in the process of studying it and sharing it with our research people, and I still, frankly, need to have some discussion with the State Investment Board and so I can get a better handle around this. But again, I think one of the reasons we've been successful is that we've never acted precipitously. We act prudently. We check things out, as the chairman suggested at the beginning of this hearing. And I think we ought to take a close look at that before we proceed to drop it. We've had that in place for a long time. Part of it's, you know, the historical rate of return. Howard's here. He could tell you better than I can. But the historical rate of return in the stock market decade to decade was around 10% until recently. And it goes back to the, you know, from the, I believe from the Great Depression moving forward. And in the last decade, it's gone lower than that. You know, I again, as a father of two college-age students who asked to check with my financial advisors about what's left or not left in their accounts, you know, I was going to try to make the money a little safer the last quarter. He said, well, we expect a quarter going up in the last quarter of the year, and we expect next year to be even better. So there's various thoughts about this. I'm not an investment expert, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, by any means. But I would say we've had this in place for a long time, and before we proceed to change it, we ought to really look not only at past practices, but again at the future expectations of what the rate of return is. Obviously, if you drop the actuarial value, actuarial assumption about the rate of return, it might have an effect on what employers and employees have to pay. But again, the rates that we've set right now, we think, will bring these plans to 100% of funding in a specific amount of time that's been mentioned before, I know, by the state funds. So the position of Council 5 at this point, we don't have a position on if we should lower it or not, but our position would be to take a prudent approach, to take a studied approach and not act precipitously on this. The funds are a complex matter, and that's why this commission obviously exists. And we think a lot of variables need to be looked at before we make that move, because there are positive impacts and there are negative impacts to doing that. And, again, not being a financial advisor, only a father of two college-age students trying to fund their education, I think there's a number of different thoughts about what the future holds for the stock market. So that's the best I can answer today.
Mr. Seid, as you pointed out, we very much appreciate the fact that the positive changes, reforms that we've enacted as a state of Minnesota has been the result of cooperation among all of the players, the people you represent, the people who are employees paying into the fund, and those who manage the funds, and those who make policy decisions. And as we go forward, we certainly recognize that same level of cooperation is going to be required in order for us to continue to make progress in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much for those comments. We appreciate that. We look forward to working with the commission and with our employers around the state to produce a very stable system that our members can depend on for their deferred income in the future. If I get one last point I meant to make, and I'm sorry if I could. Again, our members in AFSCME Council 5 make on average in the state about $38,000 a year. Local government, it's a little bit higher than that, probably closer to $40,000 a year. And their discretionary income, you know, for defined contributions, one of the things that's come up in negotiations, because we do have an opportunity to contribute to a defined contribution instrument as extra savings in there, that at the AFSCME bargaining units have underutilized those, not because they don't want to utilize them, but because at $38,000 a year, they don't have a great deal of discretionary income to put into those funds. And that becomes the other problem with the defined contribution piece. And with that, I'll leave it at that. But a lot of, you know, when you have folks at a lower income level, there's absolutely no question that defined benefit is a better plan for them than defined contribution. And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Seid. We will now, as I said, take comments from others who wish to be heard with regard to the design study. Yes, sir. I want to come forward and address the commission.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. My name is Morgan Fleming. I'm normally here on behalf of middle management or others or the Minnesota Workers Memorial Trust. I'm here as a civilian individual this morning. First, I'd like to welcome Senator Chamberlain and Daley to the commission. I don't usually, legislators aren't excited about serving on the commission in my memory over these 40 years. And of course, we have a member that served in the State Board of Investment, which is extraordinary to you, Representative. I would like to just tell you things that I've observed over the years and would be familiar to some of you. Briefly on the defined benefit, defined contribution argument, it goes on forever. It was hot here in the Don Moe days of 15, 18 years ago with great angst. The basic reason is human nature. Minnesota public employees have a deferred comp fund. It's a 457 plan. It is the largest, I think, I defer to Dave Burcham, single administered deferred comp plan in America. In 1978, it had about 3,000 state employees in it and about $25 million. Billy Bye, if you like sports, know that Bud Grant says the best high school athlete ever in Minnesota, and Bud Wilkinson, famous from Nebraska, football guy, came to the legislature. I was a little staffer involved. And Harry Sieben and Roger Moe, authors on a bill that allowed the marketing deferred comp public employees. I think there are now 80,000 public employees in Minnesota and north of $3 billion. That's a defined contribution, that deferred comp plan, a 457 plan, a sister or brother of a 401 or a 403. What happens in a market correction like October of 87 or 2001 or 08 or 09 that the members can call and take their money out or move their money around in the deferred comp plan? Most of them, they have Howard Bicker runs the money, thank God. There is a option, and some of you are in the plan, you can pick different kinds of instruments or allocations in your investment. Generally, people don't. Most of it is default. It doesn't perform as well as it would as if Howard had the discretion to run it for return. What happens in the corrections is people are afraid and they go very conservative on the plan. Basically, human nature is when the market goes really down, people sell. That's why people who are very knowledgeable make money, because when they sell at loss, somebody buys. I think that's the biggest argument against defined contribution plans. But I'm here to talk about the asset allocation or the bogey of 8.5%. And the history known to many, and it happened in 1989, Senator Pogemiller was the author of the Senate file, and Wayne Simino was the House author. It was really the first de facto omnibus pension bill, and it did many things. It was a result of the legislature in 1984 passed the rule of 85. Colin Peterson out in Congress was the author, and I think that John Sarna was in the House. But it was enacted in 84. It had a two-year sunset. Was not much used, the rule of 85, because even though health care costs for public employees were $400 or $500 a month then, instead of $1,200 now, health costs were so high people didn't use it. There was an attempt in 1988 to pass a rule of 90, which didn't exist. It passed the House with 90-some votes, failed in the Senate by two. So through 88, 89, through the rest of the year in 88, the bargaining units all got together, the AFL-CIO and their affiliates or members, then called Minnesota Federation of Teachers and AFSCME, the Teamsters and the MEA, and worked all through that fall of coming up with a proposal for the 89 session. Jim Hacking, Lori's Hacking's roommate, was running PRA at the time, and he ran all the intellectual stuff, and then the unions coordinated the political work or whatever. What happened in the fall in the culture was, Wayne Simino, the House author to be, said, if we're going to have benefits, they have to be paid for. They have to be paid for. There was then a commission actuary because Sarna, in Sarna's reign, there was the first commission actuary. So basically what happened is the group and all their advisors went to see Howard Bicker and asked Howard if he thought it was practical to raise the assumption from 8 to 8.5%. And everyone stepped back. And it took some time, a couple weeks or so, I don't really remember. And Howard said, I think 8.5% is something I can work with. And we were deliberately mindful and understood who Howard was and deferred. So that's when the change was in the assumption. And it's run well all these years. It's run well all these years. The rule of 90, we mentioned here sometimes, it was enacted the first time in 1989. For those employees that were employed at the time of the enactment date, for employees that would follow that, it would not be eligible for the rule of 90. The reason was, is there wasn't the money that year in this restructuring to pay for it, had that discipline. So, kind of a presumption to say, but when Howard says that he's a fiduciary, and we could talk about that for weeks, and it basically just means that you shall not subordinate the interest of your party, this state of Minnesota or state employees, to anything. And he's done a very good job in that. So there are a lot of people, I'm a bystander, that have professional stationery. They're actuaries or people who do studies and all those things. But at the end of the day, the only real number, you can put assumptions in the statute to change the math, and you can change it next year. The only real number is the return. And Howard and the two fellows that are the execs of the St. Paul and Duluth Teachers Fund are the only ones in the room that have that responsibility of that real number. So I would just say history's important, as Senator Pogemiller reminds me, and the wisest person in this room about what it should be, the bogey, is Howard. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman.
And Fleming, Morgan Fleming, thank you.
Fleming, I'm sorry.
Yes, sir, that's all right. It happens often. It's a compliment to me.
All right. That's right. I was thinking...
Well, he's a famous guy.
Yeah, he sure is.
He sure is.
And you don't look like him either, so...
Too bad for me.
Yeah. Mr. Fleming slipped over into the other thing. I was going to also ask if there are people that wanted to speak, but to finish off, is there anyone else who wants to approach us, comment on the design study, the defined benefit, defined contribution study? If not, we will then continue to call on some folks who asked to be heard with regard to the actuarial assumption changes, the interest rate, the earnings rate. Kim Crockett and Pat Anderson had asked to have an opportunity to speak to that as well.
I didn't know Ms. Burton was going to present first or not this morning on the staff memo.
Would you rather wait until...
No, I presented the staff memo on the assumption issue.
Mr. Martin said it would be appropriate to hear from you now.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of my comments on the change in the rate of return, the 8.5% question. What I want to add this morning is really pretty short and simple. It would be helpful to me as an observer. I apologize, I didn't introduce myself. I'm Kim Crockett from the Minnesota Free Market Institute. It would be helpful to us, and I think to our membership, to understand how that assumed rate of return that Mr. Fleming and others were just talking about affects the investment plan, if you will, the portfolio mix, and so on and so forth. We've heard Mr. Bicker testify at other times to this commission and elsewhere that the 8.5% requires a fairly volatile, high-risk portfolio in order to achieve those kinds of returns over time. So it would be helpful to us to hear from him on what he has to do to achieve that rate that everybody admires and has admired over a long period of time, and then how the increased volatility that I believe Mark Hoveman spoke to yesterday, how the increased volatility, he noted the Deutsche Bank study that just came out, might change his point of view. And I know when he was here yesterday, he said, you know, I don't know what it ought to be. But what he does know is how he has to respond to the volatility in order to achieve that 8.5%. And I think that that would be interesting for all of us to know, and particularly in light of the fact that the market tanked while we were sitting here yesterday, and it's tanking again today with a global sell-off. And I think Representative Banyan also testified yesterday that we may not, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore. We may be in a different era, if you will, for returns. And that is certainly not my expertise, though I did grow up the daughter of a retail broker, and we ate this for dinner my entire childhood, with my dad being in the retail market business. But it would be helpful to hear from Mr. Bicker, and I had hoped to hear Mr. Martin's staff memo this morning on that issue. But in closing, I wanted to pick up on some of the themes yesterday introduced on kind of what our goals ought to be. I think everybody wants to provide public employees with a secure retirement that's competitive with the private market, in order to attract the best folks and retain them and offer them that secure, dignified retirement that we're looking for. But the system cannot put the rest of government at risk. And I think what we're seeing at the local and state level is that the costs of the system are beginning to squeeze out other areas of government. And I don't think that that's good, and that's why we're here. I also think that we ought to look at the fact that while there may be transition costs that seem prohibitive to a different kind of system, you know, how we were talking about the possible move from a DB to a hybrid system, you can't ignore the fact that there are already unfunded liabilities. Now, just since I started watching this in the last year and a half, they've swung all over the place, and I think that that goes to the volatility issue that I'd like to hear from Mr. Bicker on. But the taxpayers ultimately are the ones on the hook. They're paying the employer and the employee portion, if you will. I would also like Mr. Bicker to address the question of whether or not it really is mostly investment income that's funding these things. Again, the name Gerard Miller comes up. I can give you other people who are on GASB or former GASB board members who are really questioning that assertion nationally, and that's part of the national discussion about whether it's really that deal. And Mr. Side repeated that again, and I hear it constantly in testimony before this commission, and that's being questioned nationally, whether or not those are valid assertions. And I think that's why GASB is looking at changing how it asks the pension systems to do their job, and that's on the immediate horizon. And that would be another area that would be interesting for us to hear from both the commission staff, but also the pension plans and Mr. Bicker on how they plan to deal with those upcoming changes that GASB's looking at. Though I know that they haven't been passed, but they're again on the horizon. finally, I'd like to pick up on some of the ideas that I think I heard coming from Representative Kahn and maybe Representative Murphy yesterday, in that I think a lot of public employees are looking for choices and control over their own retirement futures. I know a lot of the police officers and school teachers and other public employees that I've met in my life as an elected official on the city level and through my work in a five-city fire department are looking for choice and control, even though they know about the vicissitudes and the volatility of the marketplace. So I'd like to add that into the discussion, where we think of public employees as adults and people who are quite capable of making investment choices. It was pointed out to me yesterday that we've got about a 25, 30-year experience level now as American citizens with things like 401ks. We didn't do that, you know, prior to the early 1980s, and it was very new to all of us. I remember I was a young attorney at the time when all those were offered, but I think as a society we do have an experience level now, an education level now, where we're a little bit more comfortable, maybe a lot more comfortable with those choices as adults. And I don't think that we should assume that public employees are somehow incapable of making decisions that private sector employees make all the time. I note that there was a comment to the study by the Nurses Association that basically said nursing is an intellectually and physically demanding profession. We don't want to go home at night and think about these things. And I was shocked by that. The nurses that I know have private 401ks, and they are very competent and very good at watching their investments, and they enjoy being in charge of their retirement funds. So I think that there's probably mixed feelings within public employees about it. We don't have a point of view on what we ought to do at this point, but I do think we ought to keep those things in mind. Offering a secure and competitive retirement system to them that doesn't put state operating budgets at risk and does not put taxpayers in an untenable position to guarantee retirement levels that they may not enjoy themselves, and finally, to offer employees choices in their retirement. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Crockett. And you've asked a couple of good questions of Mr. Bicker, and I would like to give him an opportunity to respond to those. Pat Anderson, did you wish to?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to ask Ms. Crockett a question.
Would you, Senator, mention the mic, please?
Several times the, and let me just read from your memo to the, in response to the study. This is on the last page of your memo. The rapid and uncontrolled growth in the cost of public employment in state and local operating budgets is crowding out dollars for core government services and exposing taxpayers to unreasonable future liabilities. And you've mentioned that again in your testimony. What's the data points you're using for rapid and uncontrolled growth and how that is crowding out? I'm genuinely unclear why you make that argument.
Well, for the state of Minnesota, we rely on the actuarial and market valuations of unfunded liabilities. Again, as I mentioned earlier, those move around a lot. I mean, just since last spring, we've seen a change in what those unfunded liabilities are. The testimony yesterday versus last year, it's amazing to me how it can move in just these huge numbers. But those unfunded liabilities are real, and while good things happened in the 2010 legislation to decrease those unfunded liabilities, they're still very much out there. I haven't seen a tally. I haven't focused in on what the all funds number is, say, for the state of Minnesota. But we are not immune to that, despite our somewhat disciplined approach and our successes in the marketplace. And I do think that there's pressure, not just from this, but from other areas of the budget, if you will, on your operating budget as a state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pogumil.
But Ms. Crockett, the data I'm aware of is that in the last few years, we actually are taking the public sector and public employment is actually taking a lesser bite out of the economy. So it's unclear to me why your characterization of rapid and uncontrolled is factual. It just seems to me that's not the case.
Well, you're talking about...
But I could be wrong.
I can provide...
The government is actually going down. I think Mr. Side just testified, is there 1,000 fewer state employees or something or less? It was a number, I forget what his number was, but the number of people in public employment is actually going down. So it doesn't appear to me that it's rapid and uncontrolled, but maybe it needs to go down further. That's perhaps a point someone could make, but rapid and uncontrolled to me sounds a little... strong.
Mr. Sorry. Chair and Senator Pogumiller, I think that if you look over time, you'll find that the size of government has grown. And I'd be prepared at another time. I'm not going to sit and argue numbers with you, but or how I characterized it. But I think that as a general proposition, that's very defensible, that over time government has grown. And also public compensation has grown. Now, whether or not that's a good or bad thing, I think depends on the position and the skills that someone brings to it. The Minnesota Taxpayers Association did a study that was released last fall just showing how compensation levels have grown to the point where in many job descriptions, they outpace even the private sector. And that's true of health benefits as well. I mean, I know that on a local level, we've been dealing with the growth of things like healthcare costs that are crowding out other areas of local budgets, and probably not just where I served, but all over the state of Minnesota. So, you know, I think you and I could go back and forth on specifics, but I think as a general proposition that that's true, and I think that's why part of the conversation in Minnesota last session and the sessions before that is just the whole idea of reinventing government to be smarter, more nimble, and part of that is just the big cost of public employees. So it would be that's where I see the data pointing, Senator Pogumiller.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To bring it back to on a pension issue,
that was related to pensions. I think it's, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Pogumiller.
I think it's just factually incorrect that there are rapid and uncontrolled growth in cost of pensions.
Well, Mr. Chairman, having the floor at this time. Thank you. I think what has triggered the memory in my mind was a comment you made as chair of the State Government Finance Committee yesterday about the fact that 10% of the state government finance budget was dedicated, the $90 million, to pensions. And that's a fixed amount. So when you have tight times, that amount doesn't go away. It stays. And this time it took up 10% of the state government finance budget. And that was had grown due to the MRF. Last year's pension reform was great. The MRF, Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund, was in a very dire situation. Everybody recognized that. It was a part of a package. But there's no question that that took a hit out of the chairman's state government finance budget or anybody who was going to be chairman at that time. That was a fixed dollar amount and does hurt because it's 10%. And so the question I had is what that $90 million is. So just in regards to a specific pension area, and that was a pretty big jump. I don't have the exact numbers yet. I'm sure we'll be getting that. That might be part of what Ms. Crockett might be referring to, but it's certainly something that in my mind is a very important consideration because it's already taking 10% of the budget. So I don't want to see that growing. I'm hoping that it doesn't grow, and we need to see to it that in any way that we can going forward in the future that our pension funds are in a situation that we don't do that anymore in the future. And so whether it's structurally or fundamentally or more of what we did in 2010, I don't know. But the real fact is that 10% already is crowding into state government finance budget, and that's a fact.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I may add, the Minneapolis closed pension funds for police and fire just opted this month to join the para system here in the state. The city of Minneapolis, you know, as everyone well knows, was very much in favor of that, and I believe the figure is saved Mayor Ibeck and the City Council of Minneapolis from going to the citizens this year for something like $17 million more to pay for that system by shifting it to the state. So I think that's a recent, fresh example of how maybe it's past promises on pensions that are catching up to. I mean, that's part of this, and that's part of the $90 million that was talked about yesterday. But it's past promises catching up to and that have to be, that maybe weren't funded. And that's part of the problem. They weren't properly funded. And so that's just a recent example, I think, of where at least the city of Minneapolis dodged a bullet by shifting it to the state. We'll see how that works out for state taxpayers. But that $17 million difference is the difference between going back for a raised levy and not in the city of Minneapolis.
Representative Kahn.
Well, just let me put a few comments into context. First of all, when we're talking about 10% of the state government finance budget, we must remember that the state, and I know you sympathize with this, Mr. Chairman, the state government finance bill is not only the smallest of all the appropriation bills, but it's also the one with the least political support. So in general, when people are looking for places to cut, that's the place that they that they look to cut. But when you say 10% of state government finance budget, that's a very small part of this of the state budget as a whole. And the police merger was passed with very strong bipartisan police and fire merger was passed with very strong bipartisan support. It's possibly true, as the speaker has said, that it's a following up on unkept promises. It was the only large funds that were not merged into the state fund, and the only mistake was it should have been done years and years ago. And you can see with legislation that was passed what happened with the problems of those funds being overextended and the fact that the state said that they were closed funds. And once they became closed funds, then it was just impossible to ever keep, you know, to ever keep going. So it wasn't, so saying that it is following up on a promise and saying that the mistake was made was that it wasn't made when all the other state, major state funds went into it, you know, was a mistake on both the legislature's part and the city's part. But that's done. It's over. I don't think anyone is going to suggest pulling out of it, and all it did was just put Minneapolis on par with the things that were done throughout the state.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ms. Crockett, in your testimony, you said that due to the state's attention to public employee pensions, you testified that other areas of government are being squeezed out. I'd like an answer a little more specific than I heard you give Senator Pogemiller. Would you give me two or three specific examples of other areas of government that are being squeezed out due to the state's attention to public employee pensions?
Well, not just public employee pensions, but just the general cost of public employment to the state of Minnesota, but also local governments throughout the state. I can't give you a specific, you know, area. I do know there's a reason why you are meeting today, this week, and next month again in the interim. There is pressure on this system. It is unfunded. Otherwise, I don't think there'd be a lot of interest and we wouldn't be here. It's unfunded, which means that in the past we've either not come up with the right amount of money to put into the system, and/or once it's in under the State Board of Investment, we're not generating enough funds at that end to fund it. So something's wrong. My comments about it squeezing out other areas of government, it would just be one of the pressures, I think, Representative Smith, on state government, where you're constantly feeling the pressure of rising costs and the pressure to then either raise taxes or reduce those costs. And public employee costs, if I'm not wrong, have a tendency to be more fixed for you than others because the state workforce is approximately 87% represented by public unions. So your flexibility as policymakers is somewhat limited. So pensions, I think, are just one area. It's also compensation, health benefits, and then benefits also after retirement that I think are just are placing an increasing pressure each year on not just the core services of government, but some of the other things that the state of Minnesota wants to offer its citizens. And I'd have to dig a little bit to give you, I mean, I suspect there are people sitting here in better position than I am to tell you where they've made choices. I don't think I can point to a situation where somebody said, well, we're not going to fund this because we're funding public employees. But I think that that's probably part of the process as you do your budgeting.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Ms. Crockett, in answer to my question, requesting you to give me two or three specific examples of where other areas of government are being squeezed out due to the state's attention to public employee pensions, I've heard your testimony this morning. I've heard phrases like tight times, reinventing government, I believe, I think, and then I just heard you answer and say you cannot give me any specifics. Would you agree that your comments this morning make for interesting testimony, but that they lack merit?
No, I would not agree with that, Representative Smith. I mean, I'm thinking about bridges falling down, potholes. I can go throughout the state of Minnesota and find that our public infrastructure is in significant disrepair as I make my way from my home down to the Capitol this morning. So it's fairly clear to me that the state priorities may not be fully in order from my perspective as a taxpayer, but also as someone who represents a nonprofit and a large membership of taxpayers and interested folks throughout the state. We are in disrepair. We are in financial distress. And I think any attempt to paint a rosy picture of things is a mistake. And the fact that I'm not a state representative, I'm not a state senator, I'm not the governor. I suspect that all of you could come up with lists of things that you feel you cannot fund that should be funded, including core services like roads, bridges, the judiciary, police and fire. We've seen examples of cities throughout the state who are, you know, cutting those core services. I'm sure that that's happening at the state level as well. It's not my job. It's not what I do on a daily basis, Representative Smith, but I think it's fairly apparent that we are in distress as a state, and we wouldn't be here this morning if we're not.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have any further questions. I'm not trying to paint a rosy picture of anything. I'm simply asking this witness who has said that our attention to public employee pensions are squeezing out other areas of government. I would invite her at some point between now and session to point out specifics and drop the glittering generalities and give us some specifics.
Representative Smith, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to do that research and come up with a list. As I said, I'll just throw it out for now. Roads, bridges, potholes, core services, I think all of those things are probably at the top of the list.
Members, we've got a lot of ground to cover yet this morning. I'd like to keep us moving, if that's all right. Representative Kahn. Thank you, Ms.
Thank
Crockett.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Bicker, would you like to respond to the questions that have been directed to you and your work?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Trying to keep track of all the questions. First of all, Mr. Fleming has a much better memory of history than I do, so whatever he said, whatever. I don't remember all those types of things. There's a couple of things that were asked. One is, what about asset allocation if we go from 8.5 to 8? Well, with the study that I shared with you all yesterday, using the asset allocation we have today with the expected returns in the market today, we wouldn't change the asset allocation a bit. I mean, we need to maintain the same asset allocation we have now using market input to get 8. The asset allocation right now, that's that survey that we showed you yesterday showed an expected return of 8.36. Now, obviously, that sounds very specific, but if my return expectation was 8.5 or 8, I'm not changing anything. So, therefore, the volatility of the portfolio is really not going to change. It's going to have the same volatility. If you felt that I had to get 8.5 on paper, given the asset allocation study that we did today, or did the last few weeks, and I had to go from 836 to 8.5, the reality, the only place to get that is to go into equity markets or private equity. Right now, I'm 80%. By law, I can't be over 85. So I'm pretty much where I can go. And the reality is the asset allocation that the State Board of Investment utilizes and that I'd recommend to my board, pretty much in the current environment, irregardless of 8.5 or 8, would stay the same. As far as a couple other issues, she had to remind me that the market went to heck yesterday afternoon, and this morning, as no much as it's down 300 right off the bat, the markets are not in good shape. And, as we discussed yesterday, so far this fiscal year, we're down. The equity markets, the U.S. equity market is down about 13% this fiscal year. International markets in U.S. dollars are probably down around 22-23%. The bond market is about flat. You add that all up, we're probably down closer to 10 as we speak. Now, again, obviously, if you can go down 10% in 2.5 months, we've got hopefully 9.5 months to do some recovering. The reality is we measure once a year, and we measure on June 30th. June 30th, that just ended, we were up 23.3. Where are we going to be next June 30th? I don't know, but it hasn't been fun so far. There's been some discussion about people's ability to run their own money as far as a defined benefit versus defined contribution. Yeah, I really don't necessarily want to get into the debate. I just want to say two factual things, and I don't think you can dispute these. If we went to a defined benefit plan, a defined contribution plan, and it was run like the state's deferred comp plan, and people want daily flexibility and all that stuff, for the most part, it would be run through mutual funds. Mutual funds, when you go through it all, probably charge you about a 1% fee. We run all the assets for the state at about 0.1%. So the reality is the cost equation is about 1%, not quite 1% higher. So you're 1% behind the eight ball day one, assuming you're going to use the deferred compensation type arena. The other issue is if you're going to use that model, which I think has been used by a lot of places, the one thing that individuals, and we can't give individuals, is basically the component that's done the best for us over the years, and that's private equity and alternative investments, because they are not in the mutual fund world. They are not daily price type vehicles. So let's assume that somebody has every bit of ability that we all have in setting asset allocation, and their asset allocation is basically the same as a state board of investments. One, their costs are going to be higher, and two, they can't participate in one component that we can do. Now, Mr. Chairman and members, and I'm saying, all I'm just saying is, you know, we've heard a lot of discussion about that. That's two pieces of fact when it gets to that. Now, there are positives with defined contribution plans. There's portability issues and so on and so forth. And the idea of a hybrid plan is something that a lot of places have looked at. I am not here. That's not my area in designing plans. But as far as the investment component, those are two issues that I think everybody needs to take into consideration when you're setting those up. There are ways to, and I know some organizations have done this, and I haven't really seen it, is really run the money like we run it now and have people kind of buy into our operation instead of mutual fund operations. That is another alternative. All I know is, and Dave Bergstrom and his people can tell you more, is people, when they get into it's my money, want to look in the newspaper and see how their funds have done. If they do it through us, there is no quote. And people get excited when they can't see a quote. That quote maybe cost them a lot of money, but they like to see it. So, and then far as GASB, the reality is GASB is going to be an accounting nightmare. It's going to put a portion of everybody's liability on every school district's balance sheet, every city's balance sheet, and how all that's going to happen, I don't know. All I know is I've been in meetings and listened to people talk about it, and it's a mess. But, it's not an investment function. You would learn more from the retirement directors and the actuaries when you talk about these new GASB rules, but they're going to be a real problem. So, Mr. Chairman, I kind of think I got most of the stuff. The one thing that I get nervous about it, and I don't know how to say this, so I'll just say it, is, you know, some people have said we've done a good job or whatever. You know, we've done okay. We haven't done great. We've had bad years. We've had okay years. What we do is get in the way of the market. We're not brilliant. I mean, the market is going to give us our return. We're not playing. We're not fancy. We don't play hedge funds. We do kind of meat and potatoes kind of stuff. And, I've learned long, long ago from some very seasoned people, some of which are around this table, is you want to beat your drum when you did well, you better run hard like heck when you're doing bad. And we've had goods and we've had bads, and, you know, we've done okay, but believe me, we're not the greatest thing since sliced bread. So, Mr. Chairman, members, if there's anything else I could respond to.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Bicker. Good to hear your comments, as always. And I think that steady meat and potatoes is a very, very solid methodology, and I'm very grateful for that lack of those hedge funds and some of the derivatives and other things. So it's been great. But I think also one other aspect of the State Board of Investments and how the funds are managed that often doesn't, you hear about the asset allocation, but also I think it's the disciplined rebalancing. So when stocks are high and the percentage gets out of kilter, you rebalance And so you actually end up in a situation which a lot of people don't do, for the most part, selling high, getting in. But just because I think that dynamic of SBI is often missed. If you just take a minute or so to just talk about how that is done within your department.
Mr. Baker.
Mr. Chairman and members, Representative Kiffmeyer is correct. We do have rebalancing rules, and we abide by them, and they've been less than fun to implement sometimes. But the reality is, let's take domestic equities. Our domestic equity target is 45%. As long as we're within 5%, plus or minus, we're fine. If we're between 5 and 10%, in other words, you know, within 47.5 and 42.5, it's staff discretion. If we get 10% out of bands, in other words, 45%, if we get up to 49 and whatever the number is, or 41, we got to buy or we got to sell, and we got to go back to asset class debt. In 2008 and 2009, we had probably one of the largest stock purchase programs we ever had, and we're sitting there watching the market go down 300 points while we're doing it. And it wasn't any fun. But those discipline-type deals have probably made the state more money than anything we've ever done. And, you know, it's one of the issues, as I think Dave Bergstrom has discussed, and when you get individuals making, you know, and he sees in a deferred comp, you know, I always get calls and talk to people, you know, what should I do, what should I do? You know, I always tell them to buy canned goods and go to the wood, but whatever. The reality is that it's really hard to buy when things are going down and the world looks like it's ending. And you always want to double down when things are going up. And we have a disciplined approach where we've done a lot of selling when things have looked great, and we've done some buying when it's not been a lot of fun to do.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Bricker, I'm looking at the sheet you handed out yesterday. Could you characterize, I don't have clear in my head,